From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll explore how Black literature is gaining notoriety in Milwaukee and the people behind it. Then we'll learn about African American culinary history.
I love Black Eyed Peas, and it just reminds me when I'm eating these foods, they remind me of who I am and where I come from.
Plus, we'll bring you a new episode of Chirp Chat and share how to find community with other birders.
Go out there, find a club that is welcoming, and listen and ask questions and enjoy it. I think that's the best way to go about learning.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Black literary scene in Milwaukee is having a moment. Black-owned bookstore Niche Book Bar just opened a brick-and-mortar in Bronzeville. Homegrown talent is taking over digital spaces, and the library just named its newest poet laureate, a Black woman. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez spent some time with the people who are having an impact on this movement.
See, I was channeling. It's a birthday party for Audre Lorde and Toni Morrison. You need copper sparkles. So.
And you came in, you understood the assignment.
Yeah.
Like, all right, got this.
And the scarf is to seem scholarly and well-read.
My name is Monique Liston. I am a proud Milwaukee resident, also author of a book of poetry. And I think in this moment, if I were to describe Milwaukee's literary scene, I would call it toddler. And in the best way of like the most amazing ideas, looking no limits, boundless, and ready to grow.
My name is Aletha, and I am friends with Cree. We met through homeschooling. We were together in a homeschooling group.
Is there a word or a thought that comes to mind when you think about Milwaukee's Black literary scene?
What I'm seeing is people are tapping into and bringing to fruition a lot of the potential that exists here. There's a lot of smart people here. There's a lot of people that have ideas and projects and visions that might struggle to get off the ground. And what I'm seeing right now is some of those things like launching off. And that's beautiful to me.
My name's Dr. Quintero Sifran. A few nights ago, like we happened to be talking, I don't know how we got on this conversation, but we were talking about self-love, and I asked our daughter who's six, like, do you love yourself? And she goes, yes. And we go, great, what do you love about yourself? And she goes, everything. I was like, that's awesome, give me three things. And she's like, oh, it's hard to think about three things. And she went, I love my brain, I love my hair, and I love my skin. Like all this without missing a beat. And my husband and I both went, oh, we're doing something right. But I also realized that that's because of all of the amazing books that she has that honor and uplift, like her skin, her brain, and her hair. And a lot of that has also been possible because of these book spaces cultivated by Rooted, Niche, Cree, and all these other influences and spaces. So, yeah.
Is there a person in Milwaukee or a place in Milwaukee that you find incredibly special that helps cultivate that right now?
The library. You can find me in the library all the time.
I think you have to be excited about Niche. You have to be excited about Black women leadership. You have to be excited about Black women entrepreneurs, and you have to be excited about bookstores, and that's an opportunity to celebrate all three.
Monique, Aletha, and a handful of other folks gathered at Cree Miles' home tonight to celebrate Black literary excellence. Now, if you don't know Cree, are you okay? Because right now she is everywhere and putting Milwaukee and Black literature on the map in some really fun new ways, including hosting the Salon, which has been a longtime dream of hers.
If we're talking like classic Salon, What my plan in my head was for us to read some stuff. You can read something from somebody else. You can read something you wrote. You can just listen. You can present.
My name is Cree Miles. I am the curator of Penguin Random House's Always Black. I'm also out in these digital streets pushing books since 2017.
Or just like publicly performing something that you've kind of kept close to you. And then also to debate big ideas. I heard earlier people talking about the apocalypse. It's on its way.
So I'm reading from Audre Lorde's Eye to Eye, Black Women, Hatred and Anger. How often have I demanded from another black woman what I had not dared to give myself? Acceptance, faith, enough space to consider change. How often have I asked her to leap across difference, suspicion, distrust, old pain? How many times have I expected her to jump the hideous gaps of our learned despisals alone?
Hey, black child, do you know who you are? Do you know who you really are? Do you know you can be what you want to be if you try to be what you can be? Hey, black child.
See, I'm always curious if, like, it is exciting and is a renaissance, or if I'm in like that echo chamber where like everything that I see is just confirming that Milwaukee is wonderful because life is actually a giant algorithm. But if it is, I'm just gonna go with that. Because yeah, Syntonia and Niche opening is Mikey Apollo, their head librarian, post every single day, like, we're open, come stop by. And they did Date with a Book. The programming that they're trying to push through there is so wonderful. And also, I really feel like this in a lot of ways started with Ashley Valentine and Rooted. Also, just the library's international attention and getting nominated for a Peabody was insane. So anyway, for years I've been working on this essay called The Trap and the Erotic, which is basically my relationship with trap music and how it helped like expose me to Audre Lorde's definition of erotic. So I've been trying to marry those two things, and I'm gonna read the little rough draft that I have. Okay. I was 14 when I fell in love with trap music, like the nastiest, lewdest, most embarrassingly vulgar trap music.
All right, seminal moments. Do you have like big moments that stand out in your life where you're like, oh, this is like, it changed your life? Like, yeah. Do you have moments like that you can remember?
Middle school, getting relentlessly bullied for acting white, just did not feel good or like I was worth anything or all of the natural broodings of middle school. And I read What Happened to Lonnie Garver, and it was like an angel, like a non-binary angel, the story followed, if I'm remembering correctly. And I just remember this seminal scene where he was like, you keep trying to put me in a box, I'm not boxable, or something, just like super whatever. And I was like, right. And one of the pointed issues in my school that proof that I was not black was because I did not wear tennis shoes. I loved like ballet flats and like just whatever. And I started to not wear them because I was always getting teased. But after I read the book, I would like put really loud colored socks on and then put my ballet flats on and just like was marching through the ninth grade because of that moment, because of what happened to Lonnie Garver. I just decided I wasn't gonna take any shit from anyone anymore. So it really helped like beef me up for conflict, and which you have to actually be able to engage in life to be able to get through life.
Okay, this middle part, I'm workshopping. I'm just going to jump to the last sentence. I didn't know this at the time, but David was giving me my first glimpse into the erotic, the one Audre Lorde pins for us. Our society's deduction of erotic is to a strictly sexual experience is such a waste. Likely intentional as well.
I'm really working on bringing back Critique, the show. So literally in works with PBS and booking authors and talent and funding. And so we're in the throes of that. So I will be sure to thank Milwaukee when I get my Emmy. I'm in rare form today. I didn't get enough sleep.
When I was in my secret place listening to my problematic songs, I wasn't the girl being spoken down to. I was the one doing the speaking. T.I. told me I was a rubber band man. Trick Daddy told me I was a thug. And not in the pejorative way that the white gaze encourages us to define these words. It was the equivalent of a punk. White girls went goth. I went trap. As a lonely, misunderstood black girl who had been inundated with respectability politics, they were giving me permission to take up space, to be confrontational, to stunt. That's what I got so far.
I love this so much.
Because when I tell you the hold that Cash Money from the 99 and the 2000s have on me to this day,
While Cree was hosting and bringing folks in, there was someone else, a longtime symbol of Milwaukee's Black literary excellence, who was heading out to meet folks, specifically the city's youth.
So my name is Shelley Conley, born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Actually, raise your hand for me if you know what a poet laureate is, if you've ever heard of that.
Besides doing so much in literary spaces, Shelley Conley is Milwaukee Public Library's 14th Poet Laureate.
There's this thing that happens in every class where once you start doing the poem, they're captivated, they're locked in, and they're with you until it's done.
I was selected as the Poet Laureate. What that means is for the next 2 years,
I always say I attribute my growth in writing to Mecca Nightclub, Stillwater's Collective, Dasha Kelly. And so Mecca, it's like this dark space with wobbly chairs. The wine was not great, right? But it was like Cheers. It was like your Cheers. It was home, it was comfortable. And so it was a space that felt like home, and I felt comfortable enough, although it took a year to get there, to actually get up on that stage and do my first poem. And I never stopped. And people would ask me before I did, because I always had my journal under my arm. And so when I would leave and come, they're like, do you write? And I would say, uh-huh. Are you going to read? Nope. And then I would move around. And I would, you know, that was that. And so that was home for probably almost a decade.
That's my introduction. So I'm going to do a poem because that's what I do. My poetry is loud. It doesn't follow library rules of lowering your voice or stand and remain silent during the pledge. It shakes the earth like a stampede of lions, rumbles braggadocious like that pretty boy Ali. It pierces ears.
I have several slam titles. Now, no longer is there a Milwaukee Poetry Slam team, but there's still a National Poetry Slam platform. I had the title Grand Slam Champ a few times, which means out of all the people that competed in Milwaukee, I had the highest score. My Sister's Keeper was in, we just celebrated 11 years, so I've been the program director of that the entire time. We've worked with, each year I would say probably an average of 400 to 500 girls in the city every year for 11 years. We have a book, A Journey to Heal Self, Heal Her, that we released right in the midst of COVID that takes our curriculum and transforms it into a book. So you get all the poetry, you get all the writing prompts, you get mindful minute spaces where you can write, and then there's some short stories in there. I introduced my book, Rewind, December made a year. And again, that's a collection of the journal entries, poetry, and then most importantly, letters to my past.
You hear its footsteps before it enters. It walks with New York swag and Tim's, talks in Milwaukee street slang, rocks gold chains and white dookies. My poetry doesn't worry about acceptance. It moves against the grain.
Art in general, I think, is being recognized. And so that covers poetry, that covers visual art. I appreciate that people are inviting poetry and art into spaces that they're not traditionally in, because we know, just like music we talked about, music, art, all of those forms are healing, they're inspiring, kind of a warm fuzzy for people, you know? And so also specifically with poetry, because poetry is so important, and not just to the performer, but even the people that sit in the audience that don't write are like being fed by it, you know? It's again, it's like a safe space where you can express yourself however you see fit. I'm just, the state currently makes me really happy that there's all these doors and windows opening to let art in all the forms come through, so.
Respect like Aretha, and no matter the critique, I repeat, no matter the critique, I will never ever tell her to turn her volume down. Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. You guys were great.
That was WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. You heard him speaking with Cree Miles, a Milwaukee-based Black Book influencer, and Shelley Conley, MPL's newest poet laureate. In honor of Black History Month, the Winter Farmers Market held a celebration of African-American cuisine. There were booths serving up everything from banana pudding to barbecue, alongside the many vendors who are regularly at the market. I met up with Dig-In contributor Venus Williams at the market to learn more about African-American culinary history. Williams is the executive director of the Fondi Food Center, which puts on the market.
So we are here at the Winter Farmers Market, and this is a pretty special celebration. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Yes, today is a celebration of African American culinary traditions as we all celebrate Black History Month. And I do mean we all, because the entire country should be celebrating Black History Month, not just Black folks. So it's a very, very special day of honoring, exploring, remembering the food traditions and the foodstuffs that are rooted in African and African-American culture.
Well, let's get into that a bit. I'm looking at a lot of different stands around us. What are some of the culinary traditions that are in this space right now?
Ooh, in this space right now, there's so much food that I am going to have a food coma by the end of the market. There are stands here, vendors, businesses who have collard greens. You know, collard greens are the oldest green in the cabbage family, and they go back thousands upon thousands of years. Collard greens are a staple in our tradition, and there are probably not very many homes, traditional homes, in the African American community where you will not find a pot of collard greens brewing on a Sunday afternoon. There may be some other greens mixed in with them. We'll throw in some mustards and some kale and some turnips for sure, but collard greens are the staple of that. And it's one of those things that we brought with us when we came to the Americas.
There are a whole variety of foods that were introduced to the Americas, unfortunately, as a result of enslavement, but one of the ones that always comes to mind for me is okra.
Okra, yes.
I know it's a divisive vegetable.
I was like, either you love it or you don't. For myself, I love okra. So there are some vegetables that I eat on a weekly basis, some vegetables and some legumes. Okra is one of those. Now, I'm not sitting around chomping on okra, but it is always in a soup or a stew, and that's mainly where I eat it. I grew up eating it. My mother would make her version of succotash, and it was okra, stewed tomatoes, and corn. My version of succotash is, you know, has okra and black-eyed peas in it, and then it just depends on what else is in the house. There's normally corn in it as well, but black-eyed peas, that's another thing that we brought with us from West Africa. Many people think about the tradition of eating black-eyed peas for good luck. That's what we do in our community. Black folks, whether you like them or not, because that's another thing that people either really like or they don't. But black-eyed peas, that's a staple on New Year's Day. New Year's Day, you eat black-eyed peas for good luck. I eat black-eyed peas every week. Whether I have a barbecue black-eyed pea recipe that comes from the vegan chef, Bryant Terry. I use his barbecue black-eyed pea recipe, but then I just do black-eyed peas. I'll make black-eyed pea fritters like other people get up and make a bowl of oatmeal. I love black-eyed peas. And it just reminds me, when I'm eating these foods, they remind me of who I am and where I come from and how important those roots are. You know, I often say that land and food was weaponized against us when we were captured and brought to the Americas, you know, in force, you know, not because we wanted to be here, but we are here. And the traditions within foodstuffs that we brought with us cannot be denied and are spread now throughout all of the Americas, and especially in this nation.
There are so many different stands in this space doing so many different amazing things. What are some of the ones that really stick out to you as really embracing this culinary tradition?
When we look back at Scrumptious Consumptions, who is there with banana pudding and sweet potato pie and caramel cake,
you know, we talk about the vegetables, but we like our sweet stuff as well. That's really important. And her husband, right next to her, has barbecue. When I look at Just For You Catering and just Gina's Gracious Kitchen, you know, you're looking at the collard greens, the macaroni and cheese, the candied yams, the green beans with the potatoes in them, the dressing. All of those things are what nourish us when we sit down and break bread together within our community.
What made you want to do the farmers market in this way?
My father, may he rest in peace, was a chef, a baker, a caterer. I grew up in the city of Pittsburgh in the smallest of kitchens and the largest of kitchens. I grew up understanding that food heals, food brings people together, food stories can build bridges. And since we all have to eat, when we come together in community like this and we nourish each other, there are really no words for it. Feel the energy in this space. And yes, there are other vendors and other products to be had. However, when you bite into the Shack MKE's chicken wing, we don't know what the heck she does with that chicken wing. But my son DJ, every market, bring me 20 wings. Every single market, right? When I think about these individual businesses, I know what it takes to maintain a food business. I saw my father work very hard at this. At the very least, what I can do within the platforms that I have are support those who are nourishing us, who are putting their love and their passion and their grandmother's recipes and their grandfather's skill at smoking meat into their businesses and keeping the stories and the ancestors and the traditions alive. So it was very important to me that we focus on culinary traditions this Black History Month at the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market.
All right, so you are always reading. We are actually at a vendor right now who has a whole beautiful display of books. What are your favorites?
So Just Us Books has some of my favorite children's books that are associated with African-American food traditions and culture. Soul Food Sunday is one of them by Winsome Bingham. And it is exactly what we've been talking about. You know, it's the story in pictures and joy about those things that happen on Sundays in our homes, from the cooking of the cornbread to the braiding of the hair, and at one point, the macaroni and cheese, the cutting and chopping of the greens, and we all end up together at the table. So Soul Food Sunday is one of those books that I love to highlight during this month, and this picture is just as important. This picture of Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid. Now, it could be something else, but it will always be Kool-Aid. And it's always that fat, round pitcher as well. Yes. Look at the turkey. Soul Food Sunday.
The illustrations are beautiful.
They are beautiful for sure.
Well, Venus, thank you so much for inviting me up here.
Thank you, as always, for having me, and thank you for coming out to the Milwaukee Winter Farmers Market.
Venus Williams is the executive director of Alice's Garden and the Fondy Food Center. She regularly joins Lake Effect for a series we call Dig In. You can find our previous conversations at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll speak with the director of a short film about a woman's fertility journey. But first, we'll learn how to find your birding community in our latest episode of Chirp Chat.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. No matter how experienced you might be, birding with other people can give you a sense of belonging and teach you things you didn't know. But how do you meet other birders? For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Rita Flores-Wiskowski from the BIPOC Birding Club and Caitlin Schuhart from Feminist Bird Club. They share the benefits and joys of finding community with other birders. Caitlin starts by explaining why she joined Madison's chapter of the Feminist Bird Club.
I think part of the reason that the chapter really connected with me, and part of the reason I joined the leadership team, is to really create a more inclusive space in the birding world. So our chapter, from its very inception back in 2019, has always been about actively kind of creating a space for underrepresented identities, whether that is women that are looking for a place to connect with other women, or individuals that identify as trans or non-binary or queer or people of color. Sometimes certain folks don't always feel welcome or safe alone outdoors, or joining groups that, you know, they don't know who they're going to encounter. And having a very purposeful space for people to gather felt really important for me. And that's what drew me to joining the club and feeling like I can come here and I can be myself and I can be around other people that I know I'm going to align with. And the birds became just a huge benefit on top of that too.
Absolutely. And Rita, what about you? Why did you decide to join the BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin?
So I am on the board for the Wisconsin Metro Audubon Society, and I've really enjoyed that. And I was tasked with trying to help figure out how to make birding more diverse. And this is a wonderful group of people who are very intentional about trying to welcome people, but it wasn't working as far as bringing the diversity. And like Caitlin said, there's like that intention with the BIPOC Birding Club. You know, that's kind of the key, is to have a group with that intention. So when the BIPOC Birding Club started, it started with Dexter Patterson and Dr. Jeff Galligan. The two of them started this club. And I had known Jeff for probably 12 years before that. We've birded together and knew each other through the birding community. And he called me and told me what they had started and asked me if I wanted to join in the leadership. And I jumped at that opportunity because it just sounded like maybe this is the key, and it sure was.
So I feel similarly into what you guys were saying of wanting to find community. So for me personally, I'm in my mid-20s, and I'm learning that it's so hard to make friends as an adult. So how would you both recommend people go about finding other people to bird with? Caitlin?
Yeah, so my advice from, you might probably tell from the story that I told about how I got into the hobby, is really to go find a birding club that you feel like you connect with and go regularly. Sometimes it can feel so intimidating to go to something where you're like, I don't know anyone there. Who am I going to talk to? Like, what's going to happen? And I think for both the BIPOC Birding Club and the Feminist Bird Club in Madison, and even Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, like, we have just an absolute like treasure trove of birding outings where you can go, even if you know nothing about birds, and feel like you're truly welcomed and people are going to greet you. You're not going to feel like you're completely like siloed there by yourself just because you don't know anyone. And I think one thing that I'll add for both of us is that we also have really exciting like online communities. So if you are feeling social anxiety is a real thing. Getting out and joining a group that you don't know anyone feels a little bit difficult. But we both have really exciting online spaces where you can also connect with the groups kind of in advance and see, like, is this the right environment for me? Like, see what bird pictures people are sharing and things like that. I know the BIPOC Birding Club has a really wonderful Facebook group where people can connect and share their birding stories and share photos and talk about where they're going, plan meetups. The Feminist Bird Club Madison chapter has a Discord channel. So it's a kind of a private online space for our community where we offer similar opportunities for people to share what they're up to. There's a channel just for planning meetups if you want to kind of go out with other people. But you can also build friendships in online spaces, and then make it easier, I think, for you to show up at an outing when you already have a sense of like, okay, I feel like I know that this space is going to work for me.
So it seems like the answer is to put yourself out there. Rita, do you have any advice to add to that?
Her advice was spot on. I totally agree. Just go out there, find a group, talk to people. Conversations naturally will happen because you all have that same desire to learn, to look at birds, to enjoy nature. So it naturally happens. With the BIPOC Birding Club, when you come and you're a brand new birder, we cheer because we love that. We love the new people who are coming on. We want them to feel welcome. We're genuinely excited about having new people and getting this hobby to be more accessible to more people.
You both have really great advice. So what do you think are some of the benefits of birding with community? Like, I'd love for you both to share that joy with me. Rita, is that okay if I start with you?
Sure. Yeah, I think the benefits are really the learning opportunities. I mean, besides the community, I mean, you can really learn from other people. If they've been out there, they know how to identify the birds. They know what to watch for, what certain birds do, their behaviors. And the conversations around those unique aspects are the natural conversations as you're walking in the woods. So go out there, find a club that is welcoming, and listen and ask questions and enjoy it. I think that's the best way to go about learning. And then, you know, there's also benefit in going out by yourself, you know, just to kind of be out in nature on your own and to notice things on your own. You know, do those things too if it brings you joy. There's really no wrong way to bird. There really isn't.
Absolutely. Caitlin, what about you? What do you think are some of the benefits of birding with community?
Yeah, well, I want to echo a lot of the things that Rita mentioned. Like, there's a lot of benefit of growing your skills when you're going out with a group. One thing that we really try to let people know is, like, even if you don't have any experience birding and you're out among a group with other people that do, like, you still have some value to add to the conversation because everyone sees and hears things so differently. Someone else's eyes might latch onto a field mark that you're not used to looking at or you didn't think to look at, or they might describe a song or a call in a way that you had never thought about. That's one of the things I love about when new birders come to our group. They have completely different ways of describing things that we sometimes are so used to describing. And that is a real value add for everyone, because the more ways you have to think about those songs and those calls and those field marks, the better you become at learning them and recognizing them in all these different scenarios. Like Rita mentioned, there's a lot of, like, kind of like hidden work that goes into learning how to bird. Like, you not only have to think about identifying all the different types of birds, and Wisconsin has like nearly like 400 bird species that we could potentially have throughout the year. Then you have to think about what they look like in their different plumages throughout the year, because they might look different in the spring and the fall. They might sing different songs. They might have different calls. There's the birds themselves. And then there's the, how do I use my binoculars? How do I actually find something when I'm looking for it in a tree? The moment that you're in a group with other people, you have kind of like this really nice support system that where you can not only get guidance about how to do those things, but you also start to just like absorb all the other things that people are talking about. So when Rita was saying that these are going to be natural conversations that are coming up on the outing, like even if you're not ready to jump in and share something, you can still kind of be absorbing what other people are saying and learning how to grow those skills that you can then practice on your own.
So we've talked a lot about the joys of birding. Let's share a little bit about how people can get to those places and spaces. So for new and casual birders who aren't looking to travel too far, what are some popular birding spots you recommend people check out that are in your area? Rita, what are some in Milwaukee?
In Milwaukee, especially during the spring when the warblers and all of the very colorful birds are coming through and migrating, the lakefront is phenomenal. Sometimes I don't know where to look. It gets so birdy. I mean, there's just so much to see and you don't know where to look. It gets a little overwhelming. Milwaukee area birders are very lucky to be so close to Lake Michigan. And then inland, there's Havenwoods State Forest, which is a magical place in the middle of the city. And you can just find things there no matter what season. And also the Ware Nature Center. There's a bird walk there every Sunday, and they're always seeing things, sometimes rare things. And it's just, there's always something to see there. So we have a lot of great spots. I mean, that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg, but those are my favorites.
I think one that comes to mind, which was crazy and amazing for me to discover with you, was Hopkins Hollow.
Oh, yeah, Hopkins Hollow. So Hopkins Hollow is managed by a group called Nearby Nature, and they have been doing a lot of community science surveys at Hopkins Hollow to see what's there and just working to beautify that space. And I love Hopkins Hollow. I think it's a great place to explore.
And it's kind of in the north side of Milwaukee?
Yeah, yeah. Like 44th and Congress or Hopkins.
In the city.
Something. Yeah.
And Caitlin, what about you? What are some popular birding spots you recommend people check out in Madison?
Yeah, so Madison, man, we are absolutely spoiled by the number of green spaces and conservation parks that we have within the city, plus the state parks that are in the area too. So there are so many options. During kind of peak fall and spring migration, spots that are stopover spots for migration that are near lakes, like Lakeshore Nature Preserve on UW's campus, Lake Farm County Park, Governor Nelson State Park on the north side of Lake Mendota, Lake Caganza State Park, they're all just absolutely excellent for birding. But we also have the UW-Madison Arboretum, again, like right in the middle of town. It has such a nice variety of habitat, prairies, woods, nice like springs and creeks. Nine Springs, which is a wildlife area managed by the Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District, has just like an abundance of water birds and waterfowl, herons, like just everything you want. Nine Springs is so special. That's actually the very first spot that I went birding with Feminist Bird Club, by the way. So I have a special place in my heart for Nine Springs all the time.
I love that. Well, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. What's a bird that you like to highlight this month? Rita, I'll ask you first.
I think, you know, I'd like to highlight the boreal owl. It's small, it's kind of chunky, and when it flies, its wingspan isn't very big. I was very surprised at that. We were talking about community, and I met my friend, her name is Lori, and we took a road trip to the Saxon Bog, which is in northern Minnesota, and they are having an eruption year of boreal owls, and I had never seen one before. And we were in Duluth, actually, so we hadn't even gotten to the bog, and we were walking along a very heavily used trail, and she grabbed my arm, and we didn't even know it. We were standing right underneath a boreal owl. So as we walked away, we looked at it and then gave it a little distance because you don't want to be all up in a boreal owl's, you know, grill. But it didn't seem to mind. And it was the first time I saw one, and it was very exciting. So that's what I'm going to highlight, the boreal owl.
That's amazing. Caitlin, what about you? What's a bird you'd like to spotlight this month?
I am going to spotlight the black-capped chickadee. In part because it is a resident bird here in our area, so you're going to see it year-round, including in the winter. It is one of probably the most like active and kind of exciting birds to watch in the winter because they're busy foraging, they're finding food. It gives you a neat opportunity to kind of watch their behavior because you're likely to see them at pretty much any park that you go to in the winter. One of the other reasons, though, that I wanted to highlight them is because when you're out birding, finding chickadees can also help you find other birds. Today, when we're talking about finding other birders and finding community, to me, chickadees remind me of that.
Well, Rita and Caitlin, thank you both so much for sharing the joys of birding with me and how to find community in it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It was really just wonderful to be here today.
Rita Flores-Wiskowski is a Milwaukee area coordinator with BIPOC Birding Club of Wisconsin. Caitlin Shuhart is on the leadership team for the Madison chapter of the Feminist Bird Club. They spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. When we come back, we'll talk with the Milwaukee director of Trying, a film about fertility. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Around the world, more than 180 million women experience fertility challenges. And while each story is different, the struggles and emotions are often universal. A short film called Trying tells the story of one woman determined to have a child in the face of infertility. It captures her persistence to get the one thing she can't have. It's co-written and directed by Milwaukee native Emily Alprin. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
You wrote this along with Abby Wathen, who stars also as the lead. Can you share with us how you brought this project to life together?
Yeah, well, this is in fact Abby's story. Way back when, my God, I think it was, 2018. She was a dear, dear friend of mine, Abby, and a wonderful actress, an absolute star. She shared with me her story of infertility, and she said, I have a script. Can I send it to you? And it was heartbreaking, in part because I love Abby, and in part because I learned she was not alone. 186 million people suffer from infertility, and a staggering 1 in 4 pregnancies end in miscarriage. So while our film is based on Abby's true story, it's really also the true story of 186 million people that are more or less suffering silently. And it just felt like a story that needed to be told.
Yeah, despite the prevalence of it and the fact that so many people will go through it, it's still not talked about, even among friend groups. Like when you're fortunate enough to be let in on someone's vulnerability and their struggles with this, it's a powerful thing. So what was it like to work with Abby to bring the script to life and to get the visuals to life and to give this story a bit of a different meaning and perspective for general audiences?
Working with an actress who has gone through something very traumatic and has written about it, and then having a set of people as she remains vulnerable and available, was really hard. In part, it was just nurturing a sense of safety on set and just really taking care of Abby. And then as a director, it's how do you tell this story, right? How do we create a story that people want to watch? It's a hard subject. So I think in part for me, it was adding humor. It was adding moments of levity, trying to find any fun in trying to conceive, adding also some magical realism, wanting to make the film watchable, but also honest. So visually and emotionally, directing a film where Abby, going through something, is not only a brilliant actress in her own story, but also create a journey that 186 million people who haven't had their stories told see themselves the protagonist.
I do think it balances those two sides very well, especially for a short film. And it opens with various scenes and the phrase, here I am trying to get pregnant. So can you share some of the scenes and examples of the, we'll call it home tools, home remedies, that the character was hoping that would help with her fertility?
Yeah, it's amazing the home remedies that people try. So, a lot of this is like wellness, right? If you're trying to get pregnant, it's really important to be as healthy as you can. So it's eating well. It's like taking those disgusting supplements and making smoothies that you don't want to drink. It's going to restorative yoga classes. It's having acupuncture. You know, it's inviting your shaman friend who's going to like put crystals on you and somehow realign your chakras. You know, and then it's the sort of monotony of this cycle, right? Like the woman cycle, which was as a director actually really fun to work with because I could sort of base this entire film on a woman's cycle. But, you know, testing your ovulation, when are you ovulating? And then having sex, right? Which is just not fun anymore. It's just a job. So that was fun. That first act is really just sort of diving into the home remedies and actual needs to conceive.
I also want to talk about some scenes in here that are from a phone, like film from the phone. I assume it's a true source material from Abby. Why did you decide to include these amazing intimate pieces of content from her life? Did she bring it up? Was it something she wanted to do from the beginning?
You know, I think it was important to both of us that part of this was healing for Abby. And I don't think she ever imagined it growing to the scope that it grew into. I think in part, this was an exercise in moving through a traumatic experience, right? So there's, you know, spoiler alert, but there's this footage of her actual parents when she's telling them that she's pregnant. And it's like, I mean, they're neck and neck of the acting ability in this film. Like they're so good. And it's because they're finding out that their daughter, their youngest daughter is having a baby. And it's just this beautiful moment that how could you not include? Mm-hmm. And then there's another moment that we sort of recreated because Abby's actual husband, Ryan, is not an actor and, you know, didn't want to be in this. So we sort of recreated that.
To go back to a bit of the structure and the cycle, there's some nice, simple, clean, but powerful structure to this whole film. It has key phrases and then strictly visuals around it. So, you know, we start with here I am trying to get pregnant. And then to add to the story, here I am telling myself that everything's okay. So how did the script evolve? Did you know you just wanted these key points, these simple sentences that have so much meaning and loadedness behind them?
Yeah, well, Abby originated the first act of Here I Am Trying to Get Pregnant. I mean, that was Abby. And I think as the story unfolded and, you know, she knowing something is wrong, you're telling yourself that you're okay. Like, this is going to be fine. I've worked so hard to get this. And this is something that I don't think language really, we don't need language here. We need the voice in your head that is comforting yourself. Even when your doctor says everything's fine, but there's some part of you that knows that something is off, something is wrong. It felt really important to me to keep it sparse. That was important to both of us.
This story is just one example and represents over 180 million women who experience or are experiencing fertility challenges around the world. So how do you hope this short film adds to that conversation?
You know, I think there's a lot of processing that women don't go through. I think there's a lot of shame attached to the perceived failure to conceive. You know, we're told as a species that we need to keep the species going. You know, it's written into our body. And when you can't conceive, it almost feels like a betrayal of your own womanhood. And it feels bad. And then you're constantly bombarded, right, with the reminder of what you can't do. There's babies in shopping carts at the grocery store, and then the older siblings that are sort of lagging behind in the sugar cereal aisle. There's pregnant women at parks. There's the baby showers. There's Mother's Day. There's your sister-in-law with four kids that you see at Thanksgiving. There are these endless reminders of the one thing that you want more than anything in the world. And no matter how hard you try, you can't get it. So I think what's been really the most meaningful part of making this film and taking it on the road is the conversations that continue after the Q&As. Women approaching me in the bathroom saying that they saw their story told on film and that they never told anyone about it before. and now they want to talk about it. And, you know, that's healing. And that just feels so important and really everything that we wanted. You know, what started as Abby's healing journey has sort of moved into as many people who see this can heal as well.
Well, Emily, well done on this short film trying, and congratulations, and thanks for talking to me about it today.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Milwaukee native Emily Alprin is the director and co-writer of the short film Trying. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll help you plan a trip to one of Wisconsin's most popular vacation destinations, the Wisconsin Dells. Plus, in group chat, we'll hear from young Latinas who are working toward an inclusive future. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.